This is the Gempur Kecemerlangan listening test. There are four parts to the test. You will hear each part twice. Each part of the test, there will be time for you to look through the questions and time for you to check your answers. Write your answers on the question paper. You will have 6 minutes at the end of the test to copy your answers onto the answer sheet. The recording will now be stopped. Please ask any questions now because you must not speak during the test. Now open your question paper and look at part one. You will hear people talking in 7 different situations. For questions 1 to 7, choose the correct answer, A, B, or C. You will hear each recording twice. You now have 30 seconds to look at part 1. Now, we are ready to start. Listen carefully. Question 1. You hear a man talking about his hobby of rock climbing.
It's not for everyone, but I love the physical aspect. I started almost by accident. My uncle took me to an indoor climbing wall, and I was hooked. The start of any climb still gives me a real buzz. I've never settled for being less than the best at anything I've tried, and that's what pushed me to the standard I am now, which doesn't mean I don't think I can still improve. I get a huge sense of achievement when I finish a particularly demanding climb, and though other climbers get nervous sometimes, like when there's ice or the weather's bad, that never puts me off.
Now, listen again.
It's not for everyone, but I love the physical aspect. I started almost by accident. My uncle took me to an indoor climbing wall, and I was hooked. The start of any climb still gives me a real buzz. I've never settled for being less than the best at anything I've tried, and that's what pushed me to the standard I am now, which doesn't mean I don't think I can still improve. I get a huge sense of achievement when I finish a particularly demanding climb, and though other climbers get nervous sometimes, like when there's ice or the weather's bad, that never puts me off.
Question 2. You hear a public announcement at a family theme park.
Attention, everybody. This is Brandon Lee, and I'm the event manager for today at SeaWorld Center. If you hurry to Zone D, you can catch the spectacular Riding with Dolphins event. The next one's on at 11:05, but don't worry if you miss that, because you've got 3 more chances to see it today. We'll now be feeding the sea lions at 2:15, that's 45 minutes later than scheduled according to the programs. And whatever you do, don't miss the ever-popular penguin walkabout that starts in 30 minutes. You've never seen anything like it. See you there!
Now, listen again.
Attention, everybody. This is Brandon Lee, and I'm the event manager for today at SeaWorld Center. If you hurry to Zone D, you can catch the spectacular Riding with Dolphins event. The next one's on at 11:05, but don't worry if you miss that, because you've got 3 more chances to see it today. We'll now be feeding the sea lions at 2:15, that's 45 minutes later than scheduled according to the programs. And whatever you do, don't miss the ever-popular penguin walkabout that starts in 30 minutes. You've never seen anything like it. See you there!
Question 3. You hear 2 people talking about a course they have attended.
I enjoyed that.
It was a bit too businessy for me. I know everything's about profit these days, but I still think producing books should be more about creativity than making money.
Everything is going the same way, whether you like it or not. A friend of mine did a course on book illustration, and she said the first lecture was about costs.
Anyway, this speaker said if we're going into a book trade, we should get practices in as many aspects as possible.
I agree with that. They need an editor with a spot page on student newspaper, and I think I'll go for it. Now, listen again. I enjoyed that.
It was a bit too businessy for me. I know everything's about profit these days, but I still think producing books should be more about creativity than making money.
Everything is going the same way, whether you like it or not. A friend of mine did a course on book illustration, and she said the first lecture was about costs.
Anyway, this speaker said if we're going into a book trade, we should get practices in as many aspects as possible.
I agree with that. They need an editor with a spot page on student newspaper, and I think I'll go for it. Question 4. You hear two people talking about a film they have both seen.
Well, what did you think of that film?
I had mixed reaction, really. From what I've read, I expected it to be funnier.
I know what you mean. Just shows how different people's tastes can be, I guess. Good twist at the end, though. I wasn't expecting that. Were you?
I kind of guessed what was coming, to be honest. There were a lot of references to other films in the storyline, I thought.
Oh, you think so? Well, I wasn't quite sure what message it was trying to convey, though. One minute, it seems to be saying one thing, and the next, it was saying the opposite.
Yeah, I agree.
Now, listen again.
Well, what did you think of that film?
I had mixed reaction, really. From what I've read, I expected it to be funnier.
I know what you mean. Just shows how different people's tastes can be, I guess. Good twist at the end, though. I wasn't expecting that. Were you?
I kind of guessed what was coming, to be honest. There were a lot of references to other films in the storyline, I thought.
Oh, you think so? Well, I wasn't quite sure what message it was trying to convey, though. One minute, it seems to be saying one thing, and the next, it was saying the opposite.
Yeah, I agree.
Question 5. You hear a man being interviewed about a new project he has set up in his hometown.
Stephen, this new environmental project you are running, what are you hoping to achieve?
Well, Susie, the town I live in, Marlbury, is a very pleasant place to live, clean and tidy. The problem really isn't with Marlbury and such, but it's a wider problem, that of the dangers of rubbish to wildlife. So, I got all the retailers in town together and showed them a film I'd made on this subject. And as a result, they've agreed to use paper bags instead of plastic ones. Recycling was introduced very successfully last year, and I'm hoping that my new project will have similar success.
Now, listen again.
Stephen, this new environmental project you are running, what are you hoping to achieve?
Well, Susie, the town I live in, Marlbury, is a very pleasant place to live, clean and tidy. The problem really isn't with Marlbury and such, but it's a wider problem, that of the dangers of rubbish to wildlife. So, I got all the retailers in town together and showed them a film I'd made on this subject. And as a result, they've agreed to use paper bags instead of plastic ones. Recycling was introduced very successfully last year, and I'm hoping that my new project will have similar success.
Question 6. You hear a man talking on the radio about salespeople.
Professional salespeople can sell anything to anyone, and they do this by using very basic psychological techniques. Buyers normally have certain requirements by which they will judge the suitability of a product. The seller therefore attempts to find out what these conditions are by building a bond, asking questions about hobbies, family, and the like. But you need to remember, the seller is only interested in closing the deal. At its most extreme, salespeople will even attempt to mirror the body language of the buyer. If the buyer laughs, then so will the seller.
Now, listen again.
Professional salespeople can sell anything to anyone, and they do this by using very basic psychological techniques. Buyers normally have certain requirements by which they will judge the suitability of a product. The seller, therefore, attempts to find out what these conditions are by building a bond, asking questions about hobbies, family, and the like. But you need to remember, the seller is only interested in closing the deal. At its most extreme, salespeople will even attempt to mirror the body language of the buyer. If the buyer laughs, then so will the seller.
Question 7. You hear two friends talking about a student website.
The college website is out again. Have you seen it?
Yes, they've been working on it for a month. And it's better now. I thought, if they've got sponsorship from local companies, there'd be too many advertisements. But it's okay.
Yeah, that's not a problem. They must have got someone in from the design department to work on it. Because there's some real improvements. It's not so dull.
Especially the artworks on the homepage. They want people to send in ideas so they can change the layout regularly.
Okay, so long as it doesn't get too complicated and you waste time figuring out how to get to the page you want.
Now, listen again.
The college website is out again. Have you seen it?
Yes, they've been working on it for a month. And it's better now. I thought, if they've got sponsorship from local companies, there'd be too many advertisements. But it's okay.
Yeah, that's not a problem. They must have got someone in from the design department to work on it. Because there's some real improvements. It's not so dull.
Especially the artworks on the homepage. They want people to send in ideas so they can change the layout regularly.
Okay, so long as it doesn't get too complicated and you waste time figuring out how to get to the page you want.
That is the end of part one. Now turn to part two. You will hear part of a radio interview with an author called Mickey Smith, who is talking about becoming excellent at sport. For questions 8 to 15, choose the best answer, A, B or C. You now have 1 minute to look at part two.
Today on the programme we have Mickey Smith, author of the book The Power of Practice. Mickey, in your book you talk about what makes a champion sportsperson. Your argument is that talent, a natural aptitude or skill, doesn't exist, right?
Right. I know that's controversial because it's thought that people are born with natural abilities. I have my critics, but the evidence from research I've done backs up my argument. If you look at anyone who's reached a high level in any complex task, you'll find they've spent many years building up to it. This has started other people thinking and doing their own research. I've no doubt they'll reach the same conclusions I have.
What about physical abilities like speed? Isn't that what makes one footballer better than another, for example?
There are physical issues that are significant in some activities. However, in virtually all complex tasks, the limiting factor is a mental thing. People don't become the greatest footballers because they move around the pitch quickly. While he may not realise it, the way a great footballer understands where his teammates are around him on the field is what helps him score goals, rather than speed.
In your book, you also talk about geographical areas where lots of people become experts in the same activity. Gymnastics, for example.
The town I grew up in produced the top gymnasts of my generation, myself included. My initial reaction when I got to the top was, wow, I must have been born with this ability to do gymnastics. But what about the others? What I now understand is that this excellence was down to having access to a fantastic coach and a seven-day-a-week gymnastics club where we transformed ourselves from ordinary to extraordinary. Opportunity's another factor determining success.
Your argument is that to become excellent, you have to practice for thousands of hours. That's a lot of training.
That's right. How successful you are is down to how long you're prepared to work. Evidence suggests those who make it believe excellence relies on practice. If you believe being good at something is down to natural ability, when you fail, you'll think you don't have enough of it and you're more likely to give up. If you believe excellence is about effort, when you fail, you're going to see it as an opportunity to grow.
What approach should coaches take when training youngsters in sport?
The way to go about it is to ensure the child enjoys what they're learning, that it becomes an internal desire to progress. Coaching young people is more about psychology than it is about the technical side of things. It's making the young performer really care about where they're going, motivating them in the right way that will enable them to actually get there. Little difference from how you encourage adults, really.
Why don't more people who play sport try harder to improve?
Well, they see sports stars and assume they were born brilliant, but there's no evidence to suggest that. You just don't see the painstaking process it took to get them there when they're winning games on your TV screen. If you did, their brilliance wouldn't seem so miraculous. The illusion is to think they got there quickly and think, oh my goodness, I could never get up that slope.
Given everything you've said about top performers, why do they sometimes fail at crucial moments? That's called choking, right?
Yes, it's to do with the expectation to succeed, no matter how many times they've done it before. When you first practice a skill, you have to exert conscious control over it. When you become proficient, you're able to do it subconsciously. When you choke, you become so anxious that instead of delivering your skill automatically, you become conscious of what you're doing, and it's like you've never done it before.
Now, listen again.
Today on the programme, we have Mickey Smith, author of the book The Power of Practice. Mickey, in your book, you talk about what makes a champion sportsperson. Your argument is that talent, a natural aptitude or skill, doesn't exist, right?
Right. I know that's controversial because it's thought that people are born with natural abilities. I have my critics, but the evidence from research I've done backs up my argument. If you look at anyone who's reached a high level in any complex task, you'll find they've spent many years building up to it. This has started other people thinking and doing their own research. I've no doubt they'll reach the same conclusions I have.
What about physical abilities like speed? Isn't that what makes one footballer better than another, for example?
There are physical issues that are significant in some activities. However, in virtually all complex tasks, the limiting factor is a mental thing. People don't become the greatest footballers because they move around the pitch quickly. While he may not realise it, the way a great footballer understands where his teammates are around him on the field is what helps him score goals, rather than speed.
In your book, you also talk about geographical areas where lots of people become experts in the same activity. Gymnastics, for example.
The town I grew up in produced the top gymnasts of my generation, myself included. My initial reaction when I got to the top was, wow, I must have been born with this ability to do gymnastics. But what about the others? What I now understand is that this excellence was down to having access to a fantastic coach and a seven-day-a-week gymnastics club where we transformed ourselves from ordinary to extraordinary. Opportunity's another factor determining success.
Your argument is that to become excellent, you have to practice for thousands of hours. That's a lot of training.
That's right. How successful you are is down to how long you're prepared to work. Evidence suggests those who make it believe excellence relies on practice. If you believe being good at something is down to natural ability, when you fail, you'll think you don't have enough of it and you're more likely to give up. If you believe excellence is about effort, when you fail, you're going to see it as an opportunity to grow.
What approach should coaches take when training youngsters in sport?
The way to go about it is to ensure the child enjoys what they're learning, that it becomes an internal desire to progress. Coaching young people is more about psychology than it is about the technical side of things. It's making the young performer really care about where they're going, motivating them in the right way that will enable them to actually get there. Little difference from how you encourage adults, really.
Why don't more people who play sport try harder to improve?
Well, they see sports stars and assume they were born brilliant, but there's no evidence to suggest that. You just don't see the painstaking process it took to get them there when they're winning games on your TV screen. If you did, their brilliance wouldn't seem so miraculous. The illusion is to think they got there quickly and think, oh my goodness, I could never get up that slope.
Given everything you've said about top performers, why do they sometimes fail at crucial moments? That's called choking, right?
Yes, it's to do with the expectation to succeed, no matter how many times they've done it before. When you first practice a skill, you have to exert conscious control over it. When you become proficient, you're able to do it subconsciously. When you choke, you become so anxious that instead of delivering your skill automatically, you become conscious of what you're doing, and it's like you've never done it before.
That is the end of part two. Now turn to part three. You will hear five short extracts in which people are talking about happiness. For questions 16 to 20, choose from the list A to H what each speaker says. Use the letters only once. There are two extra letters which you do not need to use. You now have 30 seconds to look at part 3. Speaker 1.
What is happiness? From an early age, happiness for me is sitting in a boat in the middle of a lake on a summer's day and doing some serious fishing. All alone, just me and my thoughts. No stress, get away from it all for an hour or so. But maybe not completely aimless, not just lying on a beach somewhere, but having some task to do. Then, when it's all over, it's back to normal life and problems and hassle and having to fight to get what you want. But that brief moment of happiness helps me to reflect and make sense of my life.
Speaker 2.
I think to be happy, you do obviously need some financial security. Not rich, I didn't say that, because there's an important difference. Also, I'd say you need humour in your life. That's kind of obvious too. Having lots of free time to do what you want. Not sure there. I'd say quite the reverse, actually. For me, you really appreciate your moments of leisure when you've done lots of hard work. If it's all play and no work in your life, then you don't enjoy it. So for me, it's all to do with setting yourself a list of things to get through. And then you've completed them, now you can be happy.
Speaker 3.
I sometimes wonder if being happy is something to do with age. Very young children are happy most of the time. Very old people are happy when they think of fond memories, and also they're happy when they see their grandchildren happy. So happiness is not just specific to one age group. That's certainly the case with my family. But in my experience, happy people get through life more easily. If you take things seriously all the time, that's when you get stressed or have health issues, maybe. And sometimes life can be a real pain, let's be honest.
Speaker 4.
Happiness comes in many shapes and forms. Personally, I'm happy when I'm active, doing my sports, and feeling all healthy. But maybe that's a rather self-centered view. I also get moments when I'm just, say, sitting on a train, and suddenly I think of my children's smiling faces and realize how lucky I am, how happy they make me. And my husband, too, of course. My life could have turned out much worse, as it has for many people. Will I still be happy when they've all grown up and gone away? I'm sure when that time comes, I'll find a new form of happiness.
Speaker 5.
It's sometimes said that you make your own happiness, and I've got some sympathy for that view, but in my experience, it's something more than that. It might sound strange, but I honestly think it's all about your life not being too easy. If everything in your life is handed to you on a plate by rich parents, then I actually don't think you're as happy as someone who's had to struggle a bit in their life. When you can share your struggles with others and laugh about how you got through them, that's when you're truly happy. That's certainly how it's worked out for me.
Now, listen again. Speaker 1.
What is happiness? From an early age, happiness for me is sitting in a boat in the middle of a lake on a summer's day and doing some serious fishing. All alone, just me and my thoughts. No stress, get away from it all for an hour or so. But maybe not completely aimless, not just lying on a beach somewhere, but having some task to do. Then, when it's all over, it's back to normal life and problems and hassle and having to fight to get what you want. But that brief moment of happiness helps me to reflect and make sense of my life.
Speaker 2.
I think to be happy, you do obviously need some financial security. Not rich, I didn't say that, because there's an important difference. Also, I'd say you need humour in your life. That's kind of obvious too. Having lots of free time to do what you want. Not sure there. I'd say quite the reverse, actually. For me, you really appreciate your moments of leisure when you've done lots of hard work. If it's all play and no work in your life, then you don't enjoy it. So for me, it's all to do with setting yourself a list of things to get through, and then you've completed them, now you can be happy.
Speaker 3.
I sometimes wonder if being happy is something to do with age. Very young children are happy most of the time. Very old people are happy when they think of fond memories, and also they're happy when they see their grandchildren happy. So happiness is not just specific to one age group. That's certainly the case with my family. But in my experience, happy people get through life more easily. If you take things seriously all the time, that's when you get stressed or have health issues, maybe. And sometimes life can be a real pain, let's be honest.
Speaker 4.
Happiness comes in many shapes and forms. Personally, I'm happy when I'm active, doing my sports, and feeling all healthy. But maybe that's a rather self-centered view. I also get moments when I'm just, say, sitting on a train, and suddenly I think of my children's smiling faces and realize how lucky I am, how happy they make me. And my husband, too, of course. My life could have turned out much worse, as it has for many people. Will I still be happy when they've all grown up and gone away? I'm sure when that time comes, I'll find a new form of happiness.
Speaker 5.
It's sometimes said that you make your own happiness, and I've got some sympathy for that view, but in my experience, it's something more than that. It might sound strange, but I honestly think it's all about your life not being too easy. if everything in your life is handed to you on a plate by rich parents, then I actually don't think you're as happy as someone who's had to struggle a bit in their life. When you can share your struggles with others and laugh about how you got through them, that's when you're truly happy. That's certainly how it's worked out for me.
That is the end of part 3. Now turn to part 4. You will hear a woman called Angela Thomas, who works for a wildlife organization, talking about the spectacled bear. For questions 21 to 30, fill in the missing information in each numbered space. Use no more than one word for each space. You now have 1 minute to look at part 4.
Thanks for inviting me tonight. As you know, my main interest is in conservation, and I'm lucky enough to work with lots of different organisations looking after animals both in captivity and in the wild. I'd been fascinated by all kinds of bears for a long time before I started working in this field, but it was the spectacled bear that really attracted me. Some people find it appealing because of its size and shape, and it's less well known than other types of bear. But for me, I thought it was such a great name. It comes from the patches of yellowish fur around the bear's eyes, which grow in a sort of circle shape, like glasses. Although these golden markings vary greatly from one bear to another and may not be limited to the eyes, they can extend as far as the bear's cheeks or even chest. I'd like to explain what we know about this bear and why I find it so fascinating. It's the only survivor of a type of bear that once ranged across America during the last ice age. We thought that it was only found in certain places, in Venezuela and Chile, but I was thrilled to read some reports that suggested it might also be living in northern parts of Argentina and eastern Panama. It's quite difficult to find spectacled bears in the wild because they are quite shy animals and tend to live in a wide variety of habitats, which can range from dry coastal deserts to high mountain areas above 4,000 metres. They are most commonly found in forests, though. Being such timid animals, they tend to come out at night, which is another thing that makes them difficult to see. Though, like me, you may be surprised to learn that they don't sleep all through the winter, as many other types of bear do. We're not sure about the actual number of spectacled bears that remain in the wild, but it's been estimated that there are only about 2,400 still around. The bears are endangered, not so much because they are hunted by other animals, but what I find really sad is the fact that humans destroy their habitat. Spectacled bears are quite small compared with other bears, and of course they do have other enemies. These mostly include mountain lions and jaguars, but they remain a smaller threat. The bears are primarily vegetarian, and their normal diet is tree bark and berries. On rare occasions, though, they eat honey, which I thought was just something in children's books. I was interested to find that they are incredibly good climbers. And one thing I found really funny is that they've been known to sit up in a tree for days. They make a platform. Why? I couldn't guess. But they're waiting for fruit to ripen so they can eat it. It's quite surprising that although they rarely eat meat, they have extremely strong jaws and wide, flat teeth. Very occasionally they do eat meat, something like birds or insects, though they like small mice best if they can get them. We're really trying to make people more aware of the bears, and we've made a television series about one man's efforts to make people understand the dangers facing the animals. He spent a long time in Peru studying them and has published a very funny diary of his time there. I hope everyone will read it and support our efforts to help these fascinating creatures. So, are there any questions?
Now, listen again.
Thanks for inviting me tonight. As you know, my main interest is in conservation, and I'm lucky enough to work with lots of different organisations looking after animals both in captivity and in the wild. I'd been fascinated by all kinds of bears for a long time before I started working in this field, but it was the spectacled bear that really attracted me. Some people find it appealing because of its size and shape, and it's less well known than other types of bear. But for me, I thought it was such a great name. It comes from the patches of yellowish fur around the bear's eyes, which grow in a sort of circle shape, like glasses. Although these golden markings vary greatly from one bear to another and may not be limited to the eyes, they can extend as far as the bear's cheeks or even chest. I'd like to explain what we know about this bear and why I find it so fascinating. It's the only survivor of a type of bear that once ranged across America during the last ice age. We thought that it was only found in certain places, in Venezuela and Chile, but I was thrilled to read some reports that suggested it might also be living in northern parts of Argentina and eastern Panama. It's quite difficult to find spectacled bears in the wild because they are quite shy animals and tend to live in a wide variety of habitats, which can range from dry coastal deserts to high mountain areas above 4,000 metres. They are most commonly found in forests, though. Being such timid animals, they tend to come out at night, which is another thing that makes them difficult to see, though, like me, you may be surprised to learn that they don't sleep all through the winter, as many other types of bear do. We're not sure about the actual number of spectacled bears that remain in the wild, but it's been estimated that there are only about 2,400 still around. The bears are endangered, not so much because they are hunted by other animals, but what I find really sad is the fact that humans destroy their habitat. Spectacled bears are quite small compared with other bears, and of course they do have other enemies. These mostly include mountain lions and jaguars, but they remain a smaller threat. The bears are primarily vegetarian, and their normal diet is tree bark and berries. On rare occasions, though, they eat honey, which I thought was just something in children's books. I was interested to find that they are incredibly good climbers, and one thing I found really funny is that they've been known to sit up in a tree for days. They make a platform. Why? I couldn't guess. But they're waiting for fruit to ripen so they can eat it. It's quite surprising that although they rarely eat meat, they have extremely strong jaws and wide, flat teeth. Very occasionally they do eat meat, something like birds or insects, though they like small mice best if they can get them. We're really trying to make people more aware of the bears, and we've made a television series about one man's efforts to make people understand the dangers facing the animals. He spent a long time in Peru studying them and has published a very funny diary of his time there. I hope everyone will read it and support our efforts to help these fascinating creatures. So, are there any questions?
That is the end of part 4. You now have 6 minutes to check and copy your answers onto the answer sheet. That is the end of the test. Please stop now.